All right, so it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. So today I'm trying to talk a little bit about the ingredients of a computational account of depression. Right at the end, I will take a step back from that a little bit and think a little bit more broadly about what computational psychiatry might want to and maybe can achieve. Okay, so depression. So you should notice that the talk title said anxiety and depression. I will focus on depression because an hour just doesn't allow for two disorders, if they're indeed two separate disorders. So, depression. What is depression? Depression is not the kind of disease that you can do a brain scan and then you know whether or not to you have it, like a tumor. So modern maybe more neurological disorders. Depression really is defined by its symptoms, like many of the disorders in psychiatry. To the extent that the way we define it is actually just as a list of symptoms. So these are the DSM-4 criteria, which I imagine most people in the room will know. The most important ones are the two at the top for depression. So you have to have one of these to be called depressed. You have to either have to subjectively report depressed mood, whatever that might mean to you. You have to feel like you're depressed, you're sad, you're unwell. And or you have to have anhedonia. Anhedonia is defined as an inability to enjoy pleasures that you used to enjoy previously. Then there is a whole long list of other symptoms which at first sight look a bit strange, right? So you might have problems sleeping, you might sleep more or less, you might be gaining weight or losing weight, or there might be changes to your appetite or to your caloric intake. Psychomotor retardation, you might be slower in terms of thinking and moving. Fatigue, you might feel like you're tired, everything, you're heavy, you can't quite move, you don't have the energy. You might have thoughts of guilt, worthlessness, helplessness, so cognitive features, ways of thinking. You might have difficulty being decisive and concentrating. And finally, and this is one of the aspects that really accounts for a lot of the weight, in a sense, also of depression, is that it accounts for a lot of the suicides in the world. Now, it's a list of symptoms, and that's a disease, right? So we don't know what the underlying neurobiology is of this. We don't really know where it comes from. So here, what I'll try to do is try and maybe kind of rearrange these a little bit and think about them in a slightly broader context, and particularly in the context of computational psychiatry, and see what can we do, what can we help, how can we kind of make forward. So first, a few more words for those of you who are not too familiar with depression. So depression is often thought to be in part caused by external events. So here on the left, you see the odds ratio of developing an episode of major depression after a life event, a negative life event, something nasty that happened to you. And you see that the odds ratio there can go very, very high, above 10. As you've had more experiences, so you walk along that x-axis, actually you kind of become depressed just by itself. You don't really need a life event anymore. The kind of events that really are dangerous for depression are particularly loss events or severe stress, chronic stress. So if you're chronically stressed, you're chronically feeling like you can't quite cope. Having a mother that was depressed is also a big risk factor, arguing that maybe there's aspects that to depression that happened very early on. But one thing that's interesting and maybe important to consider is that some of the stress associated with depression doesn't happen before the depression, but happens after the depression. So it seems like depression, in some way, impairs our ability to behave in a manner that avoids stressors. So people with depression tend to behave in ways that they self-select into high-risk environment. And this points at one of the kind of ways in we'll have in terms of computational account of depression, which is to think a lot about decision-making. So there have been multiple attempts to subdivide depression. So what I've shown you before was this list of symptoms, right? And you have to have two of them and two of the top ones and a few of the other ones and then you have depression. So there's many, many, many different people who have different symptoms who all get called depressed, right? So obviously, for the past good 40 years, we've been trying to disentangle that, right? Are there subgroups of symptoms or something like that that we can take apart? A very early and very notable study was in 1965, where they tried to figure out who is it that will respond to electroconvulsive therapy. And they build an endogenous score, so a score of a type of disorder that was thought to be really not due to external events, but more due to internal events, so that kind of arose from yourself. And that if they looked at people with depression, it seemed like there were two clusters. There were some that fell into that cluster and others into that cluster. And one cluster responded better to ECT than the other. Unfortunately, it's been hard to really stick with that definition. That definition hasn't really survived the test of time. Nowadays, the maybe bigger, maybe also less careful, but bigger studies have argued that there is something like atypical depression, where people eat more and put on weight, and there is more typical depression, where people have reduced maybe pleasure in food and eat less and lose weight. And then there's differences in severity. It depends a lot, these studies, exactly what it is that you pay a lot of attention to when you record the data, and that defines a little bit what you're going to get at the end. So the most one of the more recent ones from the Netherlands, the Lamas et al.'s 2010 study, put a lot of focus on metabolic issues. So they looked at metabolic syndrome, which is something that's associated with obesity and type 2 diabetes. And so they saw a component of that that had a lot to do with atypical depression. But overall, it's been difficult to really take apart these symptoms and find subgroups in this big number of, in this big load of symptoms. So when people do research, how do they tend to approach this? The research in neuroscience has maybe often focused on particularly one symptom. That's the symptom of anhedonia, a difficulty to enjoy pleasure, to enjoy rewards. And it makes sense why we would focus on that. It's kind of the one we can most easily think of tests in the lab and in tasks, etc. The second one might have been one that is also being focused on, which is much more difficult to assess in animals, for instance, so there's much more less neurobiology and less translational work, is depressed mood. Right? So depressed mood is something that it's hard to define behaviorally. You really kind of have to ask the person. So it's mainly people who work in that realm that have worked on that. Something else that there has been a lot of work on is this indecisiveness and concentration difficulty, because those are cognitive aspects that we can measure using a lot of different tasks. So if we look, however, at the prevalence of the symptoms and exactly what really makes it most likely that you have this whole set of symptoms that gives you the label depression, it turns out that maybe that's not quite right. So the most important one, so here they did a reasonably large study, and they just did a very, very careful, they carefully recorded all the symptoms that people had. And they just looked at the kind of consistency, right? Which symptoms best predict that you have enough symptoms to really satisfy the diagnosis of depression. And so what you find is that the most important symptom is really depressed mood. It has a negative predictive value of 90%, so if you don't have it, chances are you don't have depression, and a positive predictive value of 86%. It has a very high sensitivity of 92%. If we think about anhedonia itself, that has a very good a positive predictive value. So if you do have anhedonia, chances are you have something like depression. But the sensitivity is a lot lower, so we miss out on a lot of people. And maybe one feature that is being investigated much less is the notion of energy or fatigue or diminished drive. And it turns out that really is the one that does best overall. It really has a very high sensitivity and a very high negative predictive value. So if you don't have this, chances are you don't have depression. Although there's many different ways that you might have it, so it's not that specific. So that's one aspect. So when we do research, we need to be kind of cognizant of the fact that there are many of these symptoms, and if we focus on one particular one, we might miss out on others. And quite what that means for clinical aspects is a bit tricky. So something else I didn't tell you is that to get a diagnosis of depression, you need 5 out of these 9 symptoms that I listed. Now, if we look at So this was a study that looked at kind of the consequences of having more and more symptoms. And actually, I do have one of these pointers, don't I? Oh, yes, that does work. Good. So what they looked at here is either minor depression, where you have less than 5 symptoms, then major depression with 5 or 6, and major depression with 7 to 9 symptoms. And now you can look at a variety of aspects of help seeking, and it increases kind of gradually with the number of symptoms. And aspects of kind of social function, are you employed, does it work at home, they also increase gradually. There's certainly nothing particular that happens at 5, which is where we say this is what where depression begins. So when we do research, we should also think about that, right? Do we really want to stick with this arbitrary number of 5 or not? Okay, maybe the last bit of depression. How does depression really happen? Well, this is one of the early, very, very large studies that looked at kind of the distribution of depression and depression symptoms and lots of other psychiatric disorders. And what they find was that one of the best predictors for whether you're going to get depressed over a year's time is whether you have a few depressive symptoms. So low-level depressive symptoms are a strong risk factor for later on developing more depressive symptoms. Now, if you look at exactly which ones they are, the kind of symptoms that really kind of stick around for a long time and have a high predictive value for depression are things like helplessness, worrying, brooding, and decreased self-esteem. And so what it looks like, it looks like you have these, they kind of happen very early on. And as you get more depressed, you kind of accumulate more of these other symptoms. And these other symptoms that come late, they disappear earliest again. And the last ones to disappear are these ones. It's kind of a build-up and a build-down of symptoms. Okay, so depression is a disorder of emotions, in a sense. Well, what we said, the key aspect to depression is moods. So what are moods? Well, tricky. So let's think about emotions first. And really you can think of two very simple definitions of what emotions might be. The first one is one that maybe comes more from animal research. And maybe you could say that it's a neurovegetative state of evolutionary importance. So things like fight, flight, and fright. Right? So they are innate response tendencies to kind of behaviorally salient events, like a snake that might want to eat you. And these really are innate. So this is one of my very, very nice experiment. So these are two different mountain voles. They live to the east and west of this range of mountains, and they have different predators. On the one side, it's wet and rainy by the Atlantic, by the Pacific, and they get eaten by different predators. Here, this predator is faster than them, so you better be calm and hope that he doesn't see you, because if he does see you, he'll eat you. These mountain voles are faster than the snakes. So here, the right response is to run. So what Hirsch and Boas did now in the 80s is that they bred these two types of mountain boas true for 4 generations in the lab. So for a long, for 4 generations, nobody had seen any of their predators. Then they put them into a terrarium with the predators, and they looked at how many got eaten. And it turns out that the survival rate was higher for your species-specific predator. Right? So these things are innate. They stick around. Okay, so that's one aspect. But the other aspect, which really has come from cognitive theories, more cognitive theories after since the 60s and 70s, is that most of the time, that's not the kind of emotions we talk about when we have emotions in our daily lives. Now, you might find it threatening to your existence if somebody asks a nasty question at the end of a talk, but really, we're not in that realm, right? We're not being quite eaten. And so cognitive theories posit that emotions really happen a little bit differently. Here, it is the interpretations determine kind of what value an event has. So if somebody smiles at me on the tube, and I think, oh, that's a nice guy. He just smiled at me. That's nice, and I will experience some sort of pleasant emotion. If somebody smiles at me on the tube, and I think he's laughing at me, that's going to produce a slightly less positive emotion. So the way we interpret particular events can determine what kind of emotions we have. And so, in a sense, if we want to think about the difference between these two, then here we have to have some sort of model of what is happening, some sort of model that explains what this other person, what made this other person do what they did, or what led to the particular event in the environment. We have to have some sort of explanation for it. So the difference between the two is maybe that this is really reflexive, so you reflexively react to something that's kind of innate, whereas here you reflect on the causes of the event, and that helps you to assign it some sort of value. So let's just think about these Pavlovian influences. So, you know, I said maybe they're really present in animals, maybe that's not what we really care about in humans. Sorry, this is utterly outdated. It's been published for several years now. But, okay, so this was a task which I think Mark might have talked about yesterday, so you all know it very well. So we had very clever UCL undergraduates do a very, very difficult task, which is to press a button or not. And you had to press the button. Well, you chose whether to press the button. Here you got rewarded for pressing the button. Here you got rewarded for not pressing the button. You avoided the loss if you pressed the button, and here you got punished if you pressed the button. So, what did you manage? So, you were very good at learning to press the button for money, excellent, and you're very good at not pressing the button when you got punished for it. However, and so that shows the learning curve, so you're very quick in this situation and very good at this situation. However, when you had to just sit there and enjoy the rewards of not doing anything, you found that really, really tricky. So you learn very slowly and just didn't quite work out. And when you had to not do something to avoid a punishment, that was very difficult too. So as I'm sure Mark has pointed out yesterday, it seems like expectations of rewards. So the thing is, up here you expect rewards, down here you expect losses. So it seems like when you expect rewards, you like to do something active. When you expect punishment, you like to not do something. And so if we include that in the model, so if we do a very simple model where you really just do what is best, so it's a simple instrumental learning task, then that model here in green really doesn't capture the data. What we need to include is something like a Pavlovian bias. So this means that it hard codes the tendency that when this value is positive, you like to press the button. When it is negative, you like to not press the button. And this is learned just slowly by prediction errors. And then that captures the data beautifully. So even in humans, we see these Pavlovian biases influencing our decision making. So these are kind of two ideas of moods, of emotions. So maybe we can think of moods as biases towards particular emotions. Right? So that's maybe going to be our way we're going to think about it for now. You might want to argue with it, but let's stick with it for now. So now let's think about reinforcement learning as a quantitative framework for working on that. So let's just take one quick step back. So you might have heard about MARS levels of description. So when you build a model of a particular phenomenon, there's different ways you can build the model. So there's one way where you can really try and replicate exactly what the machine does. Right. You try to replicate what it does and how it achieves what it achieves. Another way to build a model is to try and figure out what does it want to do, right? What are its aims and what are the general principles underlying what it's trying to achieve? So imagine building a model of our visual system. On the one hand, you could say, well, how can I recover three-dimensional information from two-dimensional images, right? So what are the... What's the computation, what's the mathematical issue, the statistical problems I have to solve? And then and that would be a computational description. So in our case, we can think about what do emotions achieve? And so by the definition we have so far, we could say, well, they guide the response by values, right? That's our kind of definition for the moment. And this other level, this algorithmic, is how is this being achieved? How do I actually implement it and actually achieve, solve this problem? So now we can think of the various kind of aspects of reinforcement learning. So maybe model-free, model-based learning, some sort of sampling approaches, some sort of innate Pavlovian tendencies, etc. And then there's a third level, a descriptive level. And the descriptive level really doesn't care about why something is happening or how it is happening, it just describes what is happening. And that's something that maybe we should come back to at the end. So now let's think about applying this kind of framework to psychiatry. But the computational level, it's a little bit tricky because in a sense, what is being achieved is kind of not being achieved, right? We're saying this is a disease, so it's not being achieved. And there's a gazillion ways of not achieving something, right? You imagine trying to run 100 meters, you might forget to turn up, you might show up without with your skiing gear, you might, there's lots of things that could help you not achieve. Algorithmic, how is it being computed? Now this is also tricky in psychiatry, right? Because how are we going to go about distinguishing the computation and the algorithmic? How do we find out whether the problem is that you're kind of solving the wrong task or it's some sort of failure in implementing? And the symptomatic and the descriptive one is one that's been done extensively in psychiatry, right? It's kind of the one that we went to after we decided Freudian approaches were not so useful. So there's a lot of just purely describing the symptoms, and that's basically done, right? We shouldn't really expect much from describing symptoms in more detail. At the neurobiological level, that hasn't been done, in part probably because the problem is just much, much bigger, right? What's the relevant outcome? What's the relevant thing we want to, you know, the symptoms is what brings a patient to the doctor. So what should we look for in the brain? What's the relevant thing to describe here? So maybe we can think about a different way slightly about how to structure our approach to psychiatry. And that would be that when we think about psychiatry in computational neuroscience, really we think about failure modes in a sense. And there's really three rough failure modes that we can kind of easily distinguish. The first one maybe is that the wrong problem is being solved, but all the neural machinery is doing the right things. It's all solving properly, but the wrong problem. So the kind of things you can think of maybe that might be involved here are something like drug seeking, right? So given that I want the drug, I do all the right things to get the drug. Works fine, right? The problem is that I want that drug, right? So I'm solving the wrong problem. Maybe you might be solving the right problem, but wrongly. So the vast majority of the kind of decision-making problems we face, we cannot solve, right? They're too complex. So there's there's a lot of scope for kind of errors in the approximations and in the inferential machinery. So you might just make some, it might just happen. And that might maybe speak to why psychiatric problems are so common, right? They're extremely common, and maybe this speaks to that. And third, maybe you're solving the right problem, and actually you're solving it correctly. The problem is that you're in an unfortunate environment, or you have experience, or you have learned, you have past data that leads you down the wrong path. So your data points to wrong solution. If you've experienced parents that are extremely, extremely unreliable, that, you know, abuse you, maybe you have difficulty forming trusting bonds, which means that you will have difficulty learning from people and being taken along and being helped along in life. So those are the three kind of, maybe that's useful. Okay, so now let's return to depression. So what then is depression? Well, we saw that there is an aspect that has to do with low expected rewards, depression, anhedonia, depressed mood, anhedonia, guilt, worthlessness, and suicidality. An aspect that has to do with low energy, fatigue, retardation, sleeping, maybe issues with weight. And an aspect that has to do with cognition. So let's think about the first one, this reward, right? So can we test that? So here's a nice task from Diego Pizzagalli, which is kind of a stimulus detection task. So you see a face, and then a mouse comes up. And it's either short or long. And you have to say whether it's short or long. So unbeknownst to you, the long mouse, for instance, might be rewarded more frequently, if you get it right, than the short mouse. So if in doubt, really should go for the short, for the one that gets rewarded more. And what they found initially was that in healthy subjects, this is what happened. So over time, they responded more, they were more likely to just respond, to just choose the option that was more rewarding. Whereas depressed subjects didn't show the evolution of this bias. Now, why is that? So the two questions we can ask here maybe is, is this related to learning problems or a problem in the sensitivity of reward, right? And so this now gets a little bit at these issues I was trying to. Is it that they're solving the wrong problem, or is it that they're solving the right problem wrongly, right? So if they're solving the right problem wrongly, maybe it's a problem with learning. If it's an issue with sensitivity, that they don't care about these rewards, they may be solving the right problem wrongly. So what we fitted was a simple, again, what's called a Wagner model, right? So much simpler than the volatility type models we've seen just before, just with prediction errors. And so there's two really parameters in here. One is, so you all know that dopamine represents this prediction error, right? The difference between rewarded and expected, between experienced and expected rewards. And so the question is, what does anhedonia relate to, right? Does it really relate to a reduction in the size of these rewards? What does it mean for you to gain 5 pence? Is that really worth a lot, or is it not worth that much? That would be in here, right? Whereas the problem with learning would really enter here in the learning rate. And maybe that might even speak to where the dopamine is involved and to what extent, right? So R here is effectively the beta, so that's kind of also your inverse temperature noise. Okay, so when we build a model of a task like this, we really have to try and build a reasonably detailed model of the task so that we can run it on the task and kind of get responses from the subject. So what we did is, so here subjects were instructed to do one or the other, so they were instructed to press the one button for short and the other button for long, and so we need to include that, so there's some instruction weight here. And then there is these reward weights, but of course people are uncertain about whether there is that the mouse was long or short, and so we need to average the response tendencies for that are correct for the one stimulus and the other stimulus by some sort of uncertainty weight. And if we fit this model, we can do model comparison to really ask whether all these components of this model really are necessary, and we find that really it is the model that best accounts for the data. And so if we then look at this gamma, the instruction weight, that really captures how well people do on average. Right? So it has the right flavor. So now we can look at these parameters that we're actually interested in, the learning rate and the reward sensitivity. And so it turns out that the reward sensitivity is negatively correlated with measures of anhedonia, anhedonic depression. So an aspect of, so this is just a scalar, a psychometric, a measure of anhedonia. But the learning rate really isn't. But of course, learning rate and reward sensitivity are correlated, right? You can push up one down and in exchange you can push the other one down and you get reasonably similar kind of performance. So you have to be very careful about that. So what we did is that we fit the data, then we generate surrogate data from the fitted model, and then we try and fit the data, the surrogate data again. And if it is true that we've really established something stable, something that's really present in the data, then we should be able to use the fits on the surrogate data and correlate them with the original psychometric data, and we should still see a correlation. So when we do that, So when we do that, the p-values here for reward sensitivity, they're very, very much bunched towards the left, whereas those for the learning rate are kind of towards the right here. So arguing that really there is an effect of anhedonia on sensitivity to rewards, but not on the learning rate. So in depression, it seems like they're solving the wrong problem. It's not that they solve the right problem wrongly, so far. So if they solve the wrong problem, it might be that really there's a problem in the primary sensitivity to rewards and punishments, right? So it might be that depression really makes it so, and that's the notion of anhedonia, right? So let's see, is there really evidence for that? Because so far, that was 5 cents. 5 cents is not like a snake or like an ice cream. So can we try and get at more primary rewards? So this has been tried in a number of studies, and basically, in general, the answer is there is no difference between controls and depressed patients. So here, what was done was something like a sucrose preference test. So you're given two things to drink, one that's sweet and the other one that's not sweet, but they're similar in calories, so the sweet one doesn't actually have any calorie, so you don't drink it because you're hungry or so, but really because you like the sweet taste. And this is something, this is a standard animal assessment of anhedonia, Paul Willner. Now when one does that in humans, one finds that there's no difference between patients and controls. So patients and controls equally like sweet solutions and experience the same pleasure, very much, very similar to what we just heard before in schizophrenia. So that doesn't seem to be that inherent. And interestingly enough, even though patients improved in this study with psychotherapy, this did not affect their sensitivity to sweet. And there's similar work in olfaction, and there's extensive work on pain. And on pain, generally, the finding is not that they are... So on pain, patients with depression, what would you think? So depression is associated with a lot of pain, right? You have this physical, mental pain, but actually, they have higher thresholds, so they're less sensitive to pain. So overall, it's not obvious that this primary impairment really goes in the right direction or is present at all. Now, this is a bit tricky because we all know that there's a lot of evidence that people show less emotional reactions to kind of effective events in depression. So there's a meta-analysis of lots of paths where people were shown emotional stimuli. And what they measured was a variety of responses to that. So things like galvanic skin response, affective expressions, reaction times, a variety of measures. And overall, here, you see that people show a reduced sensitivity to kind of rewarding stimuli. Now, the important thing is these stimuli were all things like movies, pictures, complex stimuli, not the more primal, low-level stimuli. So when we look at complex stimuli, we see an effect. And we also see a reduction when we look at complex aversive stimuli. And there we also see a reduction. So overall, when we consider complex stimuli, there is a blunting in the responsivity. So how does that arise? Or maybe let's do one more thing. And so, well how does that arise? And maybe one hint at how that might arise comes from work on attentional bias. So attentional biases go like this. So there's a variety of tasks again, but one task is that you have a picture appears either on the right or on the left, and your task is to detect respond as quickly as possible when you see a dot appearing. And so the idea is that if this stimulus is at the same place as the dot that appears and it attracts your attention, then you'll be faster. So now, if this on the other hand, on the other side, you should be slower. Right? So that's the differential effect of the stimulus. How much does it attract your attention? And what you find is that in depression, negative stimuli attract the attention. Whereas the same is not true for positive or neutral stimuli. Now, what's interesting about this is that this effect only starts to appear, and so up here you have the data. So, you know, in depressed, for depressed stimuli, it takes 760 milliseconds, and otherwise it takes 740. Whereas for the controls, you see absolutely no difference. So it's 609. So the interesting thing is that this only appears if this stimulus has been around for a little while. If you do it really fast, around 50 milliseconds or something like that, where people aren't aware of it, nothing happens. That's not like in panic and anxiety disorders, where you do see these effects even at very short stimulus presentation times. So it seems like if you have the time to process the stimulus, then there is this bias, right? So it seems like where do we see blunting in depression? It's when there are high-level complex stimuli and where there is time for elaboration. That's when we start seeing issues with sensitivity. So here's a nice task from Greg Siegel. And what he did was he gave people positive and negative stimuli, and then in between they had to do some sort of cognitive task. In this case it was a Sternberg paradigm, it doesn't really matter. But the trials alternated. And what he did is he looked during the time of the Sternberg, the cognitive kind of, the emotionally relevant task, and looked at whether he still saw activity due to the emotional events before. And so this really arose from a nice network model that he built of depression, and maybe I don't have time to go through it, but I recommend that you read it. And so what he sees in depressed and in control subjects is that this, so this is the response to neutral events, to negative events here in thick, and it kind of disappears over time, whereas with depressed subjects, this really sticks around during the Sternberg memory task. So it seems like people with depression, when there is a negative stimulus, and the others kind of do so less, when there is a negative stimulus, they kind of ruminate about it. It kind of sticks around, and the neural activity is persistently there. So it's kind of an issue of elaboration. So aversive is more easy to elaborate. What about appetitive? So here is a task where people saw appetitive and aversive stimuli and had to enhance or suppress the emotion associated with that. So they were told, enhance the emotion, suppress the emotion. And this is the neural activity now. This is in the amygdala, so here the controls, enhancing, attending, and suppressing. You see that they can suppress the activity, right? That's nice. And so the patients can kind of do that as well, a little bit, it's not as good. But the interesting thing is what happens here to the enhance and what these two lines are. So the blue line is the first half of the experiment, and the yellow line is the second half. And what you see is that the subjects, the healthy control subjects, they're as good at the beginning of the task at enhancing positive emotions as they are at the end of the session, whereas subjects with depression, they get worse over time. They can't quite muster the energy to enhance positive emotions. Okay, so far, we don't have primary changes, as far as we can tell, really, in depression. We do have reduced emotional responses. We have attention memory bias towards negative information. And we have this emotional stickiness. Okay. So, where does this lead us? So, what I'd like to talk about now briefly is the notion of cognitive biases. These are extremely prevalent in depression, and if you just administer a questionnaire, these are extremely strong effects. So, people with depression tend to have kind of biases that facilitate negative interpretation of events. So, for instance, extreme thinking. So, they will see things very much in black and white. Either I am very good, or I'm utterly horrible, right? Unless you're perfect, you're an abysmal person. They will attend selectively to aspects of their life. So they will not see the positive, but they will really kind of see the negative and think about it much more. They often rely on intuition. So they reason a little bit the wrong way around, in that because I have a negative emotion, that means that this situation was bad, as opposed to the emotion which responds to the situation kind of facilitates a particular interpretation of the situation itself. And they show a lot of self-reproach in that when things go wrong, they tend to take things personally. So this is very far from computational psychiatry. So let's try and go back a little bit. So one thing that's interesting is the notion of attribution, right? And we come back to this notion of models, right? So you have situations and you somehow need to explain them. So how do you go about doing that? So what I showed before was that the symptoms that happen early on and last a long time and kind of predict the onset of depression. And they are particularly things like hopelessness. So this is a big study with, I think, nearly 2,000 students, and they looked at hopeless scores, and then they took the top, I think it was 15 or 20%, and the bottom 15%. And the top 15%, the high-risk group, so those who had never had a depression, but who had high scores of hopelessness, within, I believe it was 1 or 2 years, something like close to 20% had a depressive episode, whereas in the low-risk group, there's many fewer. So it really tells you that these things kind of happen. These are around before the depressive episode. They're around for a long time before you really get a depression. It doesn't happen overnight at all. Okay, and we can be even more, and we can go even a little bit further. So this is an experiment where they looked at people's responses to bad marks in exams. So you take students and you look at the marks that people get. And they took two measures. One was kind of it was an implicit association task of self-worth. So they took it before and after, and we see that implicitly people kind of find that after a bad mark they kind of have a reduced self-worth on an implicit association task. And also they measured this with the cognitive style questionnaire. They measured how people explain events. So the cognitive style questionnaire asks you to imagine scenarios. For instance, I have a problem with a friend, and then you have to say, does this mean that I will always have problems with this friend? Does this mean that in general I have problems with friends? Does it mean that in general my life will be a bit rubbish? And so that would be a negative attributional style. And so this style kind of increases after this event. And the question is, what happens chronically after this? So 5 weeks. So they followed people and looked at the at the depressive symptoms over time. And they find that at 5 weeks, only the cognitive science questionnaire survives to predict the scores, but not this implicit association task. And the extent to which the cognitive style questionnaire, so this attributional style, comes to predict and correlate with UBDI score increases over time. So if you have this kind of way of interpreting the world, then over time, you will consolidate events in a way that will prospectively more and more facilitate negative interpretations and thereby negative emotions. So explicit interpretation really determines the long-term outcome, but both implicit and explicit determine the immediate outcome. So this brings us to the notion of emotion regulation, right? And there's different ways you can regulate emotions. So this is a paper by James Gross from 2002 where he kind of pointed out that if we want to regulate emotions, there's many different things we can do. So we can try and select the situation we're in, and that's something we saw right at the beginning, people with depression might have problems with. You can modify the situation, like you can walk away from something that's unpleasant. You can try to not attend to it. You can try to think about it differently, and that's going to be reappraisal, right? Try to change your interpretation of events. And then once the emotion has arisen, you can then try and modulate your emotional response. So you feel anxious, and you can try, just don't feel anxious, relax, relax, relax. Right? And so it turns out that this one is much more efficient than this one, because here you've already experienced some aversive emotions. And indeed, if you look at how people self-describe, this is a very short questionnaire asking what people tend to do. And what you find is that people who tend to reappraise, they tend to score low on measures of depression. Whereas people who tend to suppress emotions, they tend to score high on measures of depression and on measures of life satisfaction, self-esteem, etc. And now if you take one step into the brain, it turns out that this also influences how your brain responds to standard stimuli like fearful faces. So this was a task where people again had to regulate emotions, and the group that generally found that they often reappraise, they show this pattern of response to a negative face. Whereas the group that tends to suppress emotions, they show a much stronger amygdala response. So it seems like people who suppress emotions, they show a stronger amygdala response to negative faces, so maybe they actually have stronger emotions in a sense, right? If we think of the amygdala as being some sort of organizing center for these kinds of emotions. Okay, so emotion regulation strategies seem to be important, but the interesting thing is, so what's wrong in depression? Is it that they can't regulate their emotion? So it turns out, no. It looks like what happens is that they don't tend to regulate emotion. So this is another study where they gave people emotional films. And then afterwards, they asked them, what did you do? And so this is the spontaneous emotion regulation. And what you find is that people who used to be depressed tend to suppress emotions more than those who've never been depressed. Whereas here, on the reappraisal, in this particular scenario, there was no effect. So it seems like people choose to use different ways of regulating their emotions. Okay. So we've been very far from, we've strayed very far from equations. Right? So let's try and come back to equations a little bit. So what's emotion regulation? It's a bit strange, right? So emotion is supposed to be the consequence of my... what's an emotion, right? If we think about it in terms of an innate response to an event, well, that's supposed to be helpful, right? So I should regulate it. Why should I regulate it? It's kind of... If we think of emotions as valuations, then that means that regulating emotions means I should value things differently in order to value them differently. So it's a bit of a nightmare, I find, really thinking about emotion regulation. So, but one thing that's very interesting is to think about it as a choice. And here is how maybe we can get there. So this is a task with John Reuser and Neil Lally and a number of other people and Peter Dayan, where we asked people to plan. So you were dropped in one state, and you had various number of moves to go, and you had to press the left or the right button. And you were trained ad nauseam on this task. So, for instance, if you were here and you pressed the left button, you would always go here. If you were here and you pressed the right button, you would always go here. If you were here and you pressed the left button, you'd always go here. And if you were here and pressed the right button, you'd always go here. And so you knew that. And then we add rewards. So here you get 140 points, here you'd lose a little bit, here you'd gain a little bit on the green ones, and the red ones you'd lose a lot. 70, 100, or 140 points. And so what you should do here depends on where you start and how many steps you have to go. So let's say you're here, or let's say it's you're here and you have four steps to go. What's the right thing to do? So most people will say 1, 2, 3, 4. Actually, the right thing to do would be five steps to go. So the right thing to do if you have five steps to go would be 1, 2, and then one big loss, another big loss, and gain another reward. Right? And that's something that most people don't ever consider. So there's different ways you can solve this task, right? It's hard if you have to plan deep into the future. You have to solve one of these decision trees. You might not be able to evaluate all the possible branches. So you might just go up to a certain point and then kind of go with chance. And we see a little bit of that. So the deeper the problem, the worse people are at making choices. So they don't look all the way to the end. But we also see something else, in that people prune. So rather than cutting off the tree flatly, they cut off the tree at the large punishment. Which means that when they encounter a punishment, they choose not to continue thinking through that punishment. So here is an example. So here is how well people are at finding the optimal trajectory when the optimal trajectory does not involve a large loss, compared to how well they do at finding the optimal trajectory if it does involve a large loss. And the effect is huge. It's not that people can't do the task in a sense, it's that they choose not to think through a large loss. And this effect becomes bigger the deeper the problem. And that just shows the difference, which increases. So when we're faced with a difficult problem, we can't typically solve, we can't typically do the whole problem, so we have to approximate. And one way to approximate is to prune the decision tree. So do not think about the things that you think might not be worthwhile thinking. And in this case, the things you might think are not worthwhile thinking about are when you see that you're going to encounter a large loss, right? So that's very interesting. Now, there's many different ways of pruning decision trees, and there is some that you can be very clever about it, and you will never miss out on a big reward. And then there's approximate ones, where your tendency to stop thinking here is kind of reflexive, a bit like maybe innate. It's a bit like, you know, that mouse, that mountain vole runs away from the snake. So we went through a lot of effort in trying to show that is how it happens. And interestingly enough, it involves the anterior cingulate, which is an area which is the perigenual cingulate cortex, which is an area which is very important in depression. So what does this mean? So this means that maybe here we have a task, and I'm sure there's many other tasks, where people somehow internally choose what it is that they want to think about. Now if you think about, so what is that? So that's another decision-making problem. So that's meta-reasoning. And the problem here is that you have a limited resource, which is your amount of time that you have and how much you can keep in your head and how much you can think and how clever you are. You have a limited resource to solve this problem. So you have to apportion your cognitive resources cleverly in order to solve this task as well as possible. And that involves a decision problem of its own. And so the idea is that maybe we can get at, using computational tools, we can get at emotion regulation a little bit like that. Because people with depression make choices about what they choose to evaluate that are a little bit different from people who don't have depression. Right, so can we actually get at that detail? So here, let's just walk it through, right? So you're at this route and you have to choose whether you want to think about this branch or this branch. Well, let's say you're greedy, so let's choose this branch. Well, then you get here and now you have these two options. So let's say you're greedy, so you go down this route. So, okay, so now you're here, so what do you want to think of? Well, you want to think about this, right? So this would be the first path you would have considered if, internally, you were going to have some sort of greedy way in terms of how you choose what to think about. You always choose greedily. Whereas this path might be the second one, and the rest of the decision tree comes later. So if you include these numbers as kind of regressors in the computational model, you should see that the weight on these should be negative if indeed there is a cost that is proportional to the greedy time it takes to evaluate that branch. And we see that here in the group of subjects, and it's always negative. So it seems like we can see these internal choices about reasoning. There's another way in which we can try and get at these Pavlovian biases and how we bias thought process. And this was a study where we used a very simple, old-fashioned Pavlovian instrumental transfer task. So people were first trained to collect or leave mushrooms. So they had to press in the middle, and then they had to either approach or not approach a mushroom. And then they were rewarded or not. So for some mushrooms you got more money for collecting them, and some mushrooms you got more money for not collecting them. And then they had to perform this exact same task. But in the background there were positive or negative stimuli. And then we did the same thing, but here, right, so you press in the middle and you had to either move away from the stimulus to throw it away or not move away to keep it. And again you had to do the same thing in the background of positive and negative stimulus. So these background stimuli had previously just been associated with monetary rewards or monetary losses. And what you find in controls is that in controls, when you have to approach, negative stimuli in the background reduce the rate at which you approach and increase the rate, and positive stimuli increase the rate at which you approach. Whereas when you have to withdraw, the exact opposite happens. And this difference is entirely absent in patients. So this is the difference between these two lines and controls and impatience. And if you look at this effect in an individual, then you see that it determines over time how well people do with that depression. So these are how depressed people are 3 months later, having taken out how depressed they are at the time. And we see that the more action specificity there is, so the more positive, the more like controls they look here, the lower their depression score after 3 months. So it seems like how reflexive emotional responses influence our choices and our thoughts might not only be a path towards understanding how and why we choose to regulate emotions, so they might explain emotional regulation, but it might also help us understand how depression develops and evolves. So, I've discussed a little bit, so I've tried to give you an overview, a little bit of a somewhat personal view of how, of a kind of a computational approach to depression. I've discussed an emotional component. I've argued that there is really no primary changes. There's no pain, no hedonic taste, no sucrose differences in depression. Depression does have a lot of emotional biases. There are differences in decision making. These really occur at the conceptual level, and really they're more prominent, let's say, when interpretations are somehow involved. I argue that there is this important cognitive involvement, and that has a lot to do with interpretations. And if we think about decision making, this kind of is really in the sphere of model-based evaluation. Sorry, I haven't talked about serotonin. But I've talked about kind of this Pavlovian inference on goal-directed evaluation, so on this part. So how aspects of this might explain or lead to the kind of biases we see there. Okay, so final slide. Computational psychiatry. So let's take a quick step back. What brings patients to psychiatrists? Do they want to learn about integrating Bellman equations? No. What brings them to psychiatrists are symptoms. What do psychiatrists do? Psychiatrists have an arsenal of lovely, helpful things they can do. They're called interventions. They can help people with, they can kind of send them in the direction of social services, help them with housing, help them with finances. They can do some sort of educational interventions. They can tell the family that, if your son has schizophrenia and he smokes cannabis, that's kind of part of the illness. Don't be too harsh on him. And that can help a lot. There's some educational things we can do. Then we can do what we all know we can do. We can do psychotherapeutic interventions. But that really involves giving people skills to deal with the symptoms that they experience. We can give them pharmacological treatments. Antipsychotics or SSRIs, and then we can do weird and wonderful things like vagal nerve stimulation or deep brain stimulation. So how can computational approaches really help? Are they going to give us a novel approach to social services? No, right? Unless we think of some sort of microfinancing, then we're not going to change that. Are they going to change the kind of educational input we can have? Probably not. No, it's not going to change it. This means that computational psychiatry is not really going to change the stigma associated with psychiatric disorders. That's often very difficult. Where can computational approaches probably help? Well, probably the two places they can help most are in the psychotherapeutic and the pharmacological realms. In the psychotherapeutic, well, maybe there we might even come up with slightly novel treatments by understanding better how emotions arise. For instance, maybe we can devise a better way of helping people to change that. So here, that's somewhere where we should pay attention to. Pharmacology. Is Bellman equations going to give us a new drug? No, it's not. Right? But what it might help is by helping us understand the neural circuitry, it might identify better targets. Having said that, that's a very, very high... That's a tall order. That's not entirely straightforward. So far, the kind of computational account I've described is really kind of based on understanding, right? How do these symptoms come about? What's going on? What I would like to just say right at the end is that maybe something that we need to think about a lot as a community is to take a step back from all of this and try to just use the kind of machine learning tools that we have to just discover novel patterns that are relevant for how we choose to treat different people without trying to understand. Right. So that's it. Thank you very much indeed.